to see what the flatness constraint would give us. The flatness constraint would be a very complicated expression involving the holonomies and its derivatives. So trying to do the constraint on it would be very complicated. So what we decided to do was we look at the closed curves and we notice that they look this way. And it turns out that we can satisfy this constraint if we set all the closed curves to be the identity. After this, we have all the constraints that we need, and we can start looking at how we're going to build our physical Hilbert space. So we start with this graph. And here we have four closed curves. We have H1 until H4. And naively, from the lecture until Friday, we would try to do something like this. We would average over all the H's to get the physical state. But because H4 can be written in this way, and we have here the constraints for every closed curve, these would actually diverge. So to actually get the physical case, we just need to average over the first three loops. Another problem that we would have to face is, now that we have our physical states, is how we are going to define the inner product. And the idea is to do something very similar to what we did for the parametrized particle, in which we have a constraint. And we define the physical inner product as this. The idea behind this is that this average operator, it looks like it is Hermitian, so in principle we could pass to the other side, but it's not a typical projector. It's square, it don't square to one. So in some sense, what we are doing here is we are taking out the divergence from this to get just something that remains finite. Now, the form of the physical states would look like this, and the important thing here is that if we try to compute the physical amplitude for these states, we will notice that it will separate in two parts. No matter which state we put here, we will get something that is just like this. And this is indicating that our Hilbert space is only one-dimensional, which is expected since what we are doing here, we are just looking at the sphere, which has a trivial topology. So this is just indicating that the phase space is, I don't know how to explain very well this part. The idea here is that we have only a one-dimensional Hilbert space, and it's due to the fact that the topology is trivial.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Do I turn it off?
No.
perfect. Yeah, just to clarify, so here it's, they are not physical yet. They are just, we just solve the Gauss constraint on them. But it's just when we compute the transition amplitude, we use something like this. So it's equivalent to say that it's the transition amplitude between two physical states. OK, so there is no battery anymore. Hopefully it's going to last. OK, great. So so we're done with 3D gravity. And the idea today is to kind of give you quickly an overview what is going to be different in 4D. And of course, there are many things different in 4D. But first, let's maybe just go back to give you again the big picture to what we did since the beginning. And like this, I can emphasize on this kind of big picture where things are going to be different. OK, so in 3D, so this is just Einstein-Hilbert action. And then if you look at the equation of motion when it's for the vacuum Einstein solution, then you get this equation. So what makes 3D simple is that the Riemann tensor, so the curvature tensor, is can be written linearly into this Ricci tensor, meaning that then we get something that all our solutions are flat. Okay, so this is not the case. So in 4D, if now I go to 4D here, instead of 3, this equation is still valid, but this won't imply, contrary to 3D, that so I need to find equals 0. Okay, so in 3D we have this imply this, which then is going to tell that indeed we are dealing with a topological theory. In 4D it's not the case anymore, even in for the vacuum. So this is going to be one main difference, is that indeed 3D gravity was very simple. It was a topological theory. So then what we did, we did this change of variable where we wrote our metric in terms of triad. And then because of this triad, we have now this internal indices. So we need a connection to relate, to connect neighbor point on the internal space. So that's why we introduced this spin connection. Okay, and from that, we can show the equivalence between the Einstein-Hilbert action and the Palatini action, where here it's really written in a form that if you call EB, it's a BF, kind of BF theory. So BF theory is our topological theory for any dimension. Here we are in 3D. So what is interesting with this action is that if you look at the equation of motion, you get directly that the flatness is zero as an equation of motion. It's much more obvious than in the 3D, in the metric case. And here the torsion equals zero is not imposed a priori. It's come as an equation of motion. So this was the difference between the two formalism. Another interest of this formalism is that you can couple fermionic degrees of freedom. So then what did we do? We did the canonical analysis. Here, this gives us the canonical pair, so the connection and the densitized triad. Okay, so this is our canonical. Variables. And here we have our two constraints that are first class constraints, meaning that they generate gauge transformation, gauge symmetry. And we have two of them, the flatness and the Gauss. So the Gauss generate SU2 rotation, the flatness generate translation, and we have seen that, again, this is a characteristic of 3D gravity, that the diffeomorphism invariance is hidden into these two much simpler symmetry. So meaning that you can indeed show that diffeo can be written on shell as flatness plus Gauss constraint. OK, so this was the starting point to apply the Dirac program. So the Dirac program is a bit different from what you used to from the usual quantization program that you're applying. Usually what you do is you first, when you have you would first solve the constraint, and on your physical phase space, you will quantize your physical phase space. Here the idea is that we make a distinction between physical and what we call kinematical, and we really start quantizing at the level of the kinematical phase space. At the level of these variables, we're going to quantize. But the first step was to find basic variables that are nice, and these are the holonomy
No.
Mi flex variables. Okay, and they are nice because they're Poisson bracket now. We get rid of this distributional feature of this Poisson bracket between these variables. And then we started finding the kinematic Hilbert space. So the idea was to find a representation of this basic variable as operator. And to find a kinematic Hilbert space, we also need to find non-normal bases. So the first step is more the inner product. And then from that, we can find an orthonormal basis. And so we did that in kind of two steps. We first look at the subsystem, which is a given edge. Where here, we worked on, so our configuration variable as a group, function over the group. And then H on the graph is going to be just the tensor product of this H, E, where E are all the edges of the given graph. Okay, and then from that, so here already at this stage, we figure out we can define some geometrical operators, so the length operator. Then the next step was to go to physical Hilbert space, meaning that now we have constraints, so we need to write this constraint as operators. So here we kind of, since these constraints still are a bit complicated, but since we have a nice geometrical interpretation of this constraint, what we did was to use kind of our understanding of the constraint to implement them directly at the quantum level by group. And we impose them by group averaging. And so if we impose the Gauss constraint, what we get are the spin network states. Where it's a graph decorated by spin on the edges and intertwiner, which are invariant tensor over on the nodes. And then on a specific example, so we consider the graph associated to a tetrahedron that can be seen as the graph dual to a triangulation of a two-sphere, for example, in this case. So indeed, we consider the simplest case where the topology was trivial here. We cannot use this graph in case of a non-trivial topology. And here, we impose the flatness constraint, so on this specific graph, on this specific spin network. And what we get is that there was only one physical state given by this sigg symbol that we're going to get again tomorrow when we're going to talk about spin foam. Okay, so this is kind of what we did. So you're going to see that historically what has been done in 4D is not to go to this first order formalism, but rather to go to kind of look at the canonical analysis of the metric formulation, but then kind of everything until here is going to be the same, except that the flux is going to be a bit a different variable, because if you remember what we said that if the connection, so the configuration variable is smeared over a 1D surface, so here 1D just a link, then the flux, so the conjugated variable, so the densitized trias is going to be smeared over here, since we are going to be in one more dimension, it's going to be a 2D surface instead of a 1D. But this picture, with until even the Gauss constraint that we're still going to have, it's still going to be a C2, we're still going to have spin network states. Okay? Then, of course, this part is going to be really different. And so this variable is also going to be a bit different. And here also I want to talk about H that is going to be, that you can write kind of a union over all possible graph, then there is also a kind of equivalence class here, things that I'm going to explain quickly. And we see that you need to take the completion for a given measure that I'm going to explain. So this is going to be what we're going to see. In addition, this thing and, of course, this constraint are not going to be the same. Okay, so this one is going to be different. Okay, so let's try to see to write things maybe a bit more explicitly. So there is a Palatini action for 4D that is then going to be, so in 4D, that is not linear anymore in E, but is linear, is a quadratic. And here I have E. Okay, so this is Palatini. So here you could do kind of, and it's Lorentz invariance. So we could do a canonical analysis, but really to go to the variable we're using in loop, and in particular SU2 gauge invariance. Starting from here, we will need to, in addition, do a partial gauge fixing, which is called the time gauge. Okay, so it's a bit more complicated, it's more steps. So the way I'm going to show you today, I'm going to use kind of the way it was introduced historically, okay, by Achtekar. Achtekar started from this action. What was done at the time where I introduced this variable was people were studying this ADM formalism, okay? So the starting point is really this action, which is a function of the metric variables, okay? And here what we do, so the ADM formalism is just to do a 3+1 splitting of space-time, okay? So now it's this part is going to be 4D. And it's already a bit what I wrote in color, so in red. So maybe first, any question on the 3D part that we did for a few days, even a few weeks? Everything is crystal clear. OK, great. So maybe I can give you also a reference here for 4D that is good. So it's by Alejandro Perez. And it's called just Introduction to Loop Contrariety and Spin Foam. And you can find it on the archive. So it's already from a few years ago, but it's still really good. So this is a reference, and it's on the wiki page. Okay, so here, don't. Okay, so here, so what do we do to do the canonical analysis? Again, we do a 3+1 splitting of space-time. So we have a space line, we have some space like hypersurfaces for given time. So the phase space now is going to be, in this case, so degrees of freedom are all encoded in the metric. So your variable are going to be given by the spatial metric. QAB, so where by AB, again, I denote spatial indices. So on your surface, so here you do this splitting, where here now this is three-dimensional, okay? And you have, of course, the conjugated quanta that right now I'm not going to express. And it's related to the extrinsic curvature, okay, of this 3D surface. So these are your variables, then you have constraint, of course. And so we have a vectorial constraint that is also called the space diffeomorphism constraint that I'm going to denote like this. So, vector spatial diffeo. And we have, of course, the scalar constraint that generate time representation, okay? And so you can combine them in a bigger constraint where this generates a DFAO.
Sorry, are these the momentum and the Hamiltonian constraint, or are they like different?
So this constraint?
Yes.
Yeah, so they are all the DFAO constraint. It's just you would decompose them like DFAO on just moving things on the hypersurface. And one which is in the time direction.
Okay.
So that's why usually you introduce a lapse and shift vector. Okay. You do this kind of decomposition. But here it's really, in total, it's really all the DFAO. And again, the Hamiltonian is a linear combination of this first class constraint. But what is the issue when we, once we are here? What is the issue to apply the Dirac program is that this H mu here is really non-polynomial in the phase space variable. And so it makes the theory very complicated to quantize. Okay. And indeed, in our case here, it was also kind of complicated, but we had also a kind of nice interpretation of the constraint, so we implemented in a different way. So let's see what was Ashtekar's idea here to kind of deal with this issue and see where we are, okay? So of course, it would be well known if we would have had a full theory of gravity, but we still have some well-defined things and kind of already a nice picture. And everything that I'm going to present to you mathematically is very well-defined. So of course, the issue is going to come when once we're going to kind of wants to implement this constraint, the dynamics. But before that, everything, loop quantum gravity has a very strong mathematical. Okay. Even if today I'm just going to give you very simple, I'm going to go quickly, so I'm not going to give too many details. Okay, so then what did Abai Ashtekar was to do a change of variable and interpret, kind of use a triad formulation. So you see, instead of doing the change of variable at the level of the full metric, where here in 4D it would be tetrad to go to the Palatini formalism. Here what it has been doing is just writing something very similar to what we have been doing in 3D, because this is now 3D. And this object are triad as before, or co-triad. And it's for an Euclidean. So of course, as we already seen that in 3D, doing this change of variable is introducing new degrees of freedom. It's exactly the same thing as before. In 3D, we have at each point now of our hypersurface, we have a small, we define a small frame, and you can rotate this small frame, and this is not going to be changed, okay? So we have this additional SU2 gauge symmetry coming from that, as at least you're really familiar with the 3D case.
Sorry, is it still a triad now, or it's a?
Yeah.
It's still a triad now.
Yeah, still a triad. These are three, so here I, j are still the internal indices that are the SU2, so it's three indices, and a, b now are special, so 1, 2, 3, 2. Okay, so in our case before, okay? Here mu, we're taking three indices, three value, and I, j was also taking three different.
So yeah, so this is the metric in the induced like three slides.
Yeah, in the hypersurface. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is this metric here.
Okay.
which would be, so yeah, this is what is different from going from the Palatini, where here we would have got tetrad to do this change of variable. Okay, good. And so then, as before, we introduce a densitized triad, but it's not going to be linear in E, it's going to be quadratic in the triad. In fact, like if it was the same thing we would get here. But let me write it. So what are the variables that we're using? Is defined as A, J, K, A, B, C. So very naturally, we're going to see that it's going to be very, indeed very natural to smear that over surfaces. Okay, and this can really be interpreted as kind of the normal to the dual surface to our graph. We see that. And then we have the Ashtekar Barbero connection. In fact, we even have a family of them because there is a new parameter. And I think on Thursday, we talk about loop quantum cosmology, and maybe this parameter is going to appear again. So what does it think? So this is just the Levi-Civita spin connection, okay, where, of course, to get the internal index, you use the triad to define it. And this is related to Levi-Civita. And here is the extrinsic. Curvature. And this is what we call the Emir Z. And there's still some discussion about, so now in everything you're seeing in loop quantum gravity, this is a real parameter, okay? But initially, when Ashtekar defined his variable, he introduced that instead of this parameter, a real parameter, it was just an I here, so imaginary number. And in this case, where you get a self-dual formulation. And so, yeah, there's still some discussion about this connection, because one issue with this connection is that this connection is not, cannot be obtained as a pullback of a space-time connection, or pullback to the 3D surface of a pullback of the space-time connection, sorry. So kind of this interpretation of this connection is not so clear, but the interest of this connection is that here, again, all the constraints we're going to get are going to be first class. If you work with this case, then you get, in addition to that, you're going to get some reality condition in addition to the other constraint we're going to have. And these are going to be second class constraints. So again, we just mentioned at the classical level the first class and second class constraint, but second class constraints are not always easy to deal with at the quantum level, okay, if we don't solve them before. Okay, so then here, and of course this one, you could write it in terms of this spin connection that appear in the Palatini formulation, but to really get to this expression, so here I can give you what what is this expression, you get something like this. Okay. Plus gamma 0i, where here this is indeed the, but here this is, you get that you need to do torsion. Gauge fixing, which is called time gauge. And then you get that indeed the extrinsic curvature can be related to this part of the spin connection here. Okay, so here, these are our conjugated variables, as before. And as before, what we have is that so now we have, so there is a kappa in front of the action that come here. There is this gamma that come out, A, B. And then, of course, it's a distributional Poisson bracket as before. So as you can guess, we're going to smear the variable. And the connection is still going to, it's still SU2, so it's still going to give us this SU2 holonomies. And this now is going to be smeared into on 2D surface. OK, but this is not the end. Of course, we have constraints. Plus constraints. Again, it's a constraint system. And in fact, we really just, yeah. So Ashtekar just took this ADM formulation. So kind of the Einstein-Hilbert action written after doing the 3 plus 1 splitting of spacetime and then did this change of variable. So here you still get, so now you get the Gauss constraint in addition to the previous constraint, but we still have our vectorial constraint and scalar constraint. And of course, as we did in 3D, what we do is smearing on the constraint to know. So I'm telling you it's first class. So for this, you need to check the algebra, the constraint algebra. And then we get, and I'm going to write it because, in fact, it's not really closing in the usual way. And because of that, in fact, we don't have a really proper representation of this algebra. So I'm going. So of course, with the Gauss, it's still SU2, so we don't have any issue here. So two Gauss constraints for two different smearing parameters is again going to be a Gauss constraint, where here I consider my smearing parameter are Lie valued object. Okay, so this is the bracket between two Lie valued objects. Then now we know that these are going to generate DFEO, so we're going to get some Lie derivative here. So let's look at what is the bracket between the Gauss constraint and the vectorial constraint. And what we get is that it's a Gauss constraint is a parameter where we have the Lie derivative with respect to n. So of course, I'm writing. So can you read when it's at the corner? Is it, you can still see when I'm reading like this? OK. Well, let's try to be more. Then Gauss with the scalar constraint is going to commute for Poisson bracket. And then we have that two DFEO, special DFEO still give a special DFEO. So here we get, no, this gap, sorry, two special DFEO give S, the scalar constraint. And now the tricky part comes from if you look at two scalar constraints together. plus some terms proportional to. The Gauss constraint.
Okay, so.
But the tricky part is that this now structure function here so this one let me put name is going to depend on a field.
Okay, on your space wave function. So
here it's a field dependent. By my field, I mean my phase space function. Field dependent structure function. And so because of this, it's not really close in the usual sense, BRS sense. And this is why we don't have a really proper representation of this full algebra, okay? So, yeah. So proper, if you're familiar with this, PRS. Okay, so why it's still complicated, but let's see what we can do here with the Dirac program, okay? So it's going to be similar to what we did for the kinematic Hilbert space. It's going to be very similar to the 3D case, okay? And
we saw that the diffeomorphisms can be generated by combinations of like the Gauss and Platonic constraints.
Yeah.
So in this case, we're still in 3D, but because it's a spatial slice of four dimensions, we need additional constraints to generate the diffeomorphisms.
Yeah, so but here in total, we're in 4D. So it's just, we can indeed decompose the diffeo as what is just acting on the 3D hypersurface, so moving points around the 3D hypersurface, plus something that is moving points like in the kind of time direction, so which is going to generate dynamics. Whereas in 3D, we didn't split it. We never look at, we could have done something a bit similar in 3D, look at this constraint, deformation constraint. It's called this deformation constraint algebra, so it's quite general, this algebra that we have here. And so in 3D, we could also have kind of look at diffeo just on the 2D surface and a kind of time evolution. But because we have that the full diffeo, so in 3D, that the full diffeo, space-time diffeo, are going to be replaced by this translation symmetry, we didn't do that. Okay, but we could have done something similar. Look at the deformation hypersurface things by dividing this, so in the case of 3D, 3D diffeo, space-time diffeo into these two components. But indeed, here it's, and here we cannot really do that. We don't have this other symmetry.
I did. I have a question. And yeah. What happens in 4D if you don't do the 3+1 decomposition? Do you get, and you incorporate a tetrad?
Mm-hmm.
Do you get like another symmetry? So what? Or is you what?
Yeah, so here indeed, what is the symmetry if you write this? So if here these are space-time indices, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then here indeed the symmetry group is going to be, depending on the signature, so if it's Euclidean, it's SO4, and if it's SO31, if it's Lorentzian.
And why don't people like do that instead of the 3+1 splitting? Is it like more complicated or?
But it just, so in spin foam, this bigger gauge group,
mm-hmm.
Okay? We don't do, because we want the covariant kind of picture. So if we don't do the, then the The difficulty in the canonical formalism, then, especially with Lorentzian, is that so SO3-1 is not so nice. It's not compact, so it's not going to be a super nice group to work with. And yeah, really, the motivation of Ashtekar was really to rewrite things in terms of SU2, because then it's very close again to SU2 lattice gauge theory. And we still have all this nice property about the holonomy that commute and all the nice gauge transformation. So I know that some work has been done trying not to to introduce this, to do this splitting. And also one thing that has been introduced, try kind of to get to keep this bigger gauge group, was to work with what are called projected spin network, where they are really invariant under the bigger gauge group, and you still see the SU2 group as a kind of subgroup there. But then all the construction for at least the canonical framework is more complicated. But what has been shown with this new spin network, that are this projected spin network, is that really they appear if you work with a spin foam, normally spin foam instead of really being. So I was motivating in the really first lecture at spin foam as telling you transition amplitude between spin network states. But in fact, it's better defined if you work with this projected spin network. You already have this group invariant there. But yeah, what we really call loop quantum gravity is really working with this spin network, and it's SU2 gauge invariant. Okay, so I wanted to. Let me think about what I have time to. So the first step is to define the kinematical. Hilbert space. And so the connection is going to be smeared, and we're going to get holonomy. This is very usual. Now, what I want to emphasize, so then in the 3D case, I didn't give you so much of the technical terminology, but what we call, we're going to work with what we call cylindrical function of generalized. So let me explain what this means. And really, these are going to be the state, our state in our kinematical Hilbert space. So what does it mean, this generalized connection? So here, really, in fact, it's really just the holonomies. It's just when we, so depending on, so this question of vocabulary, it's more a question of vocabulary depending on kind of which background you come from. And for example, for Chern-Simon theory and for Kenrossi, they always use this generalized connection. So I think with holonomy, there is maybe the idea that you need to, I'm not sure what is really the difference. So, but what is the idea is here, so that now all the, we forget about, it's what we already said in 3D, we forget about connection, and we really just work with holonomies, and this is for any path, okay? So it just maybe, the idea is that we don't fix the path, and so what we call this cylindrical function, or just this function over, now for us, it's going to be group element over SU2. And the idea is that, so we denote this state, this space like this, cylindrical function, and it's going to be the union over all possible graphs. Where here, these are all the function of a group defined for a given graph, okay? So why am I telling you that? So this is going to become clear in a moment, please. So then the next step to get the kinematical Hilbert space is to have a measure. And the measure is the Ashtekar. And here, why I'm doing all that is because I want to define the full kinematical bro space and not only one defined for a given graph. Okay, so this is a graph. And it's union over all possible graphs. And we have the HTK Lewandowski measure, which is defined this way. So we denote it this way, where it's for a function over the group defined for a graph. Okay. And so the state is defined for a graph and a given function. And the way it is defined is you add, here you use just the R measure that we were using before. So this is for each edge of my graph. Let's use the same notation of the graph. This small gamma here. And then here, it's my function is going to be evaluated with group element on each edge. Okay. HE1 until HEN. Where n is the number of graph. And here is a normalized R measure that we have seen. So what is the interest now of having defining that is because now you can define really the scalar product between function defined, so cylindrical function defined for two different graphs. So here, I'm considering a graph gamma 1 and a graph gamma 2 with a function f1 and f2. And here, my scalar product is just going to be given by the product of all these R measure, where E now are the edge of, I'm going to keep this notation, gamma 1. Small gamma 2, because I'm going to use the big gamma, and I'm going to define what is this big graph. And so now I'm going to F1, E1, EN, where big N is the number of edges for this bigger graph gamma. And I'm going to explain in a minute what is this graph. Where this gamma that I call gamma 1, gamma 2 here is any graph that gamma 1 is part of this, belongs to this graph, and gamma 2 belongs to this. And so, why is this important? Okay, why is it important? It's because up to now, what we have been working in 3D, and 3D is fine because it's a kinematical, it's a topological theory, sorry. We have been working with H gamma or big gamma, if you want, meaning for a given graph. And here we are just considering a finite number of degrees of freedom, okay? But we expect, of course, that, but the element of the really what is the LQG quantum kinematical Hilbert space, so this is different from the kinematical Hilbert space, and really what is this Hilbert space of LQG kinematical is when you're going to take the union over all possible graph, and we're going to see that there is a so this kind of equality is not easy to prove, so I'm not going to prove it, especially in less than 5 minutes. But so here we have a union over all, so for all over all possible graph of this individual Hilbert space associated to a graph, and then we have a
we have,
I need to find the name, an equivalence here. So what does it, what is this equivalence mean here? So what this mean here, this means that given any function, okay, so I'm not going to explain it very well, but any function associated to a graph, okay, which belong to, of course, to a given Hilbert space for a given graph, then it, we can easily identify an equivalent representative for any bigger graph. Okay, so here, what we can do in loop quantum gravity, and it's also related to the way the merger is defined, is that we can identify here on any bigger graph. And so what does it mean? This means that here the element of the LQG Hilbert space are not states living on a single graph, okay, but are equivalent class of states. And so, and this is why this Hilbert space is going to describe the infinite number of degrees of freedom of the gravitational field, and because it's not, so the state we consider are not state living on a given graph, but are equivalent class of state, okay? And so this is quite different too. And here, what this means here, this means that here you take a Cauchy completion, so meaning that if you look at the Cauchy series, you also take their limit, right, the same way you would do to build anyway what is called a Hilbert space. So this is just mean that you take the Cauchy completion in the HD Carlevandowski measure, okay, for the HD Carlevandowski measure. But here, what is really important, and this is different from what you use in lattice gauge theory, okay, where then you will have only a finite number of degrees of freedom. Here is that in, at the end, nothing depends on graph, okay? Because the state of kinematical state of loop quantum gravity are not state living on a given graph, but are really equivalent class of state. And this can be done because it's indeed you have this relation between if for any state living on a given graph, you can find equivalent state living on bigger graph. Okay, so this is what makes that the loop quantum gravity kinematical Hilbert space can really describe a number of, an infinite number of degrees of freedom, which are what we expect since we are working with the gravitational field. And this is really different from a lattice picture. Okay, so I don't really know if this is kind of very clear here. It's a bit complicated to explain in few words, but what I want to do in the 5 minutes, then we can have questions, of course, and I can come back on that. It's kind of finished the picture that we have here in the case of 4D gravity, and then we will have time to discuss and I can answer questions. So here, so we have a kinematical Hilbert space, which is this union over all possible graph, okay, divided by this equivalence relation. So now the next step is to find an inner product and an orthonormal basis. And so the inner product is defined this way using the Hdkar-Lewandowski measure, but the orthonormal basis is really the same thing that we did in 3D, meaning that we can use the Peter Weyl theorem, okay? So here, for the orthonormal basis, it's very similar to what we add. So the orthonormal basis will still be state of this form. Okay, we use again Peter Weyl theorem. We're still dealing with function over SU2. And then again, at this level, we can define in the kinematic Hilbert space. So now, again, we can define the geometrical operator. So now we're going to have the area operator. And we can show that, again, the area operator is going to be diagonalized by the spin network state and have some discrete value. And we can do the same with the volume operator. But let me maybe go to the physical phase space quickly and where we are. So it's going to be the same for the gate, the Gauss constraint, okay? It's going to tell you that what you have here at each node is an intertwiner, okay? And it's exactly the same construction as before. So again, we consider oriented graph. Again, the property of the area and volume operator kind of give you a nice geometrical interpretation of this object, because what it's going to tell you is going to tell you that each edge is going to carry a quanta of area, and each node here or each vertex is going to carry a quanta of volume. And indeed, you can really see that here you have a surface, okay, and another one, and this is closing to form polygons. And so the volume, and so you can really see now your space, because here it's still space, okay? So it's just, we just impose Gauss. So with the Gauss constraint, the picture we have is already an atomic picture of space, okay, where each node can represent a kind of atom of space and they are glued together, and this gives you the area of the surface dual to this edge. Okay, then the next step would be to implement the spatial DFAO. And this can be done. It's a similar method as for the Gauss constraint, but here we have to be careful because it's going to be with non-compact orbit. So then we can implement the spatial DFAO. And meaning we kind of solve this kind of solution. So here it's a spin network state. And what we get a kind of natural basis here, which is called the S naught. Or if you want, abstract, depending on which. And again, the S naught is going to be defined, it's an equivalent class, again, of. So here, what is that? Well, now we use the DFAO. Of embedded. So here, at this stage, we are still embedded our graph in our space, even if what we choose, the coordinate system of the embedding does not carry any physical information, okay? All the information about the gravitational field or the geometry, if you want, are really contained here in the combinatorics relation between of this graph. So the graph, the way which node is related to which node, and the different quantum number that we have. So the quantum number that we have here are this spin and this intertwiner. Okay. So here it is. But the embedding does not contain any physical information, and indeed this is going to become really obvious when we implement explicitly the special DFAO, because here, so the equivalence class of embedded DFAO, spin network, sorry. Spin network under the action of DFAO on this surface, 3D surface, hypersurface. So meaning that here what we have is S and S prime, both belongs to S if it exists a diffeo such as S prime is related by S by the action of this diffeo. So what does it mean here? This means that this object, this S naught, is really an abstract graph defined only by the agency relation between links and nodes and by the coloring that we have, so the J and I, and by its knotting and linking property. Okay? So here, it's really similar to what we would get in knot theory. And to be more explicit, you still know how you will still know our loops are going to wind, for example, around holes in the manifold, for example, or how the edges are going to intersect with each other. But where the graph sits inside the manifold, its location, its metric properties, like length of edge, are not well-defined concept anymore. Okay, so you still have a notion of intersection. So it's always, again, relational relation. You know the intersection of links. You will know the widening of around a hole because it's also compared to things, but you don't have anything that is not relational. So the S naught is kind of purely algebraic, okay, quantum state of the gravitational field. And here, again, each edge can be seen as carrying so quantum expectation of space formed by this chunk of space, the node with quantized volume and separated with sheet of surfaces corresponding to the links here with quantized area. So yeah, the way you should see these S nodes is that they does not live on the manifold, but they define the rare by themselves, okay? So it's really you replace your manifold by this object. Okay, I'm going to conclude here. So then of course we are left with the to get the physical phase space, we are left with the Hamiltonian constraint or the scalar constraint. And here, there is no well-defined, so it's still an open problem. And in the canonical framework, there is this proposition, which is using a master constraint. So I'm not going to expand on that. But then this is a motivation one why spin foam model were introduced. And this is what we're going to, so SN means spin foam. And this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, okay? And yeah, so this was the motivation to introduce spin foam. So thanks, sorry for being late.